from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday morning, March the 4th, the day after Super Tuesday and Town Meeting Day here in Vermont. Lots to talk about this morning, and we got some good guests lined up to help us sort it all out. Steve Pappas of the Times Argus will be leading off, followed by Jim Condos. I had Jim Douglas on yesterday. Getting my Jims confused here. Actually, Jim Douglas was a Secretary of State for a while, too, so there's another reason for confusion. But Jim Condos, who will be my guest today in the second half hour, is the Secretary of State for Vermont, and we're going to talk about turnout, election results, et cetera, in when we get the Secretary of State on the phone this morning. And in the second hour of the program, we're going to have a telephonic visit with Linda Fowler. She's a professor of political science at Dartmouth College, just across the river in New Hampshire, and she's following, of course, the Democratic primary process pretty closely. We'll be checking in with her to find out her thoughts on the big Biden surge of yesterday. So we'll be checking in about that as well. But let's go to Steve Pappas first. He's the editor and publisher of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald. And I think I'm depriving him maybe some sleep he might otherwise be getting right now, which I really appreciate his willingness to, especially this morning, join us after town meeting coverage late last night. Good morning, Steve. Steve, wake up!
Steve, wake up! Good morning.
Here, you want a cup
How
of coffee?
Are you? Yeah, let the drip continue. It's you know, in journalism, small town journalism, we actually love town meeting day because it's the one day that's kind of packed with adrenaline, or election day, where everybody kind of comes in and, you know, it gets rolling, and then by the end of the night, you're kind of all adrenaline because there's just so much information you're trying to process and push through the assembly line, and you're actually creating bottlenecks, and it's great fun, and you're trying to monitor. Last night was especially fun because we were trying to not only monitor what was going on in our various towns around Washington and Rutland counties, but in the state with the primary for Bernie, and then also what was going on with Super Tuesday. And so it was a little, you know, we were kind of all hopping around to pay attention to all these different moving parts. And it turned out to be, at least from the primary point of view, a pretty interesting news cycle. From a town meeting point of view, it was pretty sleepy. You know, we can talk about the specifics of that, but, you know, certainly the primary was the most interesting part, not Bernie winning in Vermont. I think we all knew that was going to happen, and I was actually surprised that the percentage wasn't higher than it was. And Biden made a good showing in Vermont as well.
Let's talk about that big story, the national story, first off then this morning, and that is really interesting to me that all of a sudden, you know, Buttigieg and Klobuchar jump out, and we now are left with all of the people voting yesterday who were going to be maybe possibly, you know, in those early primaries there was a lot of splitting up of the moderate vote between, you know, you had some people supporting the former mayor of South Bend. You had some people supporting Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator. And then you had sort of Bernie. Elizabeth Warren has never really gotten any traction anywhere and continued not to yesterday, even in her home state of Massachusetts. So Bernie Sanders has been pretty much the dominant player in the left-hand lane. And yet, yesterday, I think what it showed, and it's probably a little bit of a wake-up call to a lot of Vermonters, we're in a little bit of a liberal progressive bubble up here sometimes, and I think people are surprised occasionally when they realize that the rest of the country is really significantly more conservative than Vermont is.
Yeah, absolutely, and it was prevalent last night. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking to other folks in other newsrooms were saying the same thing. They were saying, you know, we really do take this for granted. You know, it was exciting that Bernie was getting the momentum that he was getting, but You know, it is not surprising that he would do well in New Hampshire. It was not surprising that he was going to do well in Vermont. And, you know, the some of these states that he's done well in up to this point have seen kind of a demographic that is pushing a more progressive agenda. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the Democratic Party, you know, we were talking to somebody yesterday who said, you know, Democrats, once they started taking money, they were, you know, they all kind of went to the, they definitely went to the middle and even started going a little bit more to the right. And, you know, that's not where, as you're saying, the rest of the country kind of is. And Biden's rise is, you know, it's interesting that it's him, because of all of the people who were on the dais, you know, a week and a half ago. I wasn't necessarily convinced that it was going to be Joe Biden that was going to kind of bubble to the top, but, you know, here we are, and he is, you know, there's a handful of things that are going to happen now, and that includes what invariably I think is going to be a very messy convention. Because of the delegate count.
Yep.
I think that, you know, there's two kind of prevailing theories now that Bloomberg and Warren should probably both drop out at this point, and that if Biden were smart, he would name a VP early, and that, you know, he, fingers crossed, Obama, you know, endorses him, and that kind of clinches the Biden side of things. The other prevailing theory is that, you know, Bernie, that Bloomberg and Warren drop out, and that Bernie names that Warren to be his VP, and then that kind of gets him more moderate votes that he might not have otherwise gotten. Now, you know, it's shades of gray between Sanders and Warren as far as kind of where they are on the agenda, but she's definitely a little more to the center. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but boy, you know, the Democrats are showing that they are not happy with the direction of their party. And, you know, whatever that split is in the nation between progressives and just liberals is definitely playing out strongly at the moment. And, you know, these next few weeks are going to be even more telling.
Oh, you know, one of the things that I mean, there are many things you can remark on in the results of yesterday, but here in Vermont, I was surprised. You mentioned that Bernie Sanders didn't get as high a percentage as you expected, and I would guess that one of the reasons for your expectations might have been that back in 2016, when it was him and Hillary Clinton in the Vermont primary that year, he got 86% of the vote.
Right.
And this year he barely cracked 50.
Yeah, he did 51.
I think
we were all thinking it was going to be in the high 60s.
I mean, I thought it would be a lower than 4 years ago, but I did not have a sense that you know, it would be a bare majority. That surprised me to some extent. What do you think explains that? And here he is in his home state and barely hanging on to the majority.
I don't know. We were pontificating in the newsroom last night, but that was a bunch of, you know, overtired non-pundits with not a lot of experience. But you know, a big part of it was that a year ago I wrote an editorial actually asking Bernie not to run, which drew a lot of national attention. And at that time that I did that, a lot of Vermonters came up to me afterward and said, "We actually agree with you. We don't feel that, a Democratic socialist is the direction that we should be going."
I think a lot of people are, frankly, more comfortable with someone of that stripe in a legislative setting like the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House. Yeah, than they are with the idea of that person being the president. That's just, you know, different roles for different types of politician or whatever. You know, obviously there's quite a number of people, and yes, the majority of folks who voted in the primary yesterday, bare majority, said, you know, we still are backing Bernie Sanders for president of the United States. So give credit where credit is due. But I know that there's a strong contingent of Vermonters who believe that, you know, he's been really in some ways a breath of fresh air in the Senate for a lot of his time there and in the House before that. But they don't see him as presidential material. That's just, you know, one of the kind of range of opinions out there.
Well, you track this a lot through your guests. What, you know, what's your take on why you feel he didn't do as well this time around?
Well, I guess if I had to take a wild guess at it, and I really don't have any facts to base this up, it's pure speculation. I think that, you know, a big difference, of course, is that the what mattered was, you know, what are the other options? In other words, you know, we didn't have Elizabeth Warren in the field in 2016. We didn't have Pete Buttigieg still on the ballot, and you know, a lot of early voters in Vermont. You know, about 6,000 people. I'm going to be talking with Secretary of State Jim Condos about this in the second block of the show. But about 6,000 Vermonters went to the polls early and voted for. It looks like I think they went to the polls early because they who would have voted yesterday for Buttigieg or Klobuchar. But between Buttigieg and Klobuchar, they got about 6,000 votes in Vermont, and those had to be early voters who then watched their candidates, the people they'd just cast their ballots for, say bye-bye in the last couple days, and that's got to be kind of disappointing. But, you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles sometimes, and that is one of the, you might call it a risk of early voting. I don't mean to dismiss that out of hand as an option, but that might be something to consider when there's something like in this particular kind of election where there's a crowded primary field. Now, if you were, say, a Bernie Sanders supporter and you wanted to go vote early last week or something, I think your bet would be safe that he was going to still be in the race today. Mm-hmm. But and Joe Biden, as it turns out, would have been a good bet, although not as clear, because who knew a week ago that Biden would be so resurgent right now. And so, you know, I think that's, but it's obviously somewhat the competition. I really do think that there's a, you know, and we saw it in the general election in 2016, but there was a strong dislike throughout in some quarters, just active dislike for Hillary Clinton. And that some of that may have shown up in that 86% figure in the primary in Vermont in 2016 that Sanders got. You know, people saying they wanted to make a statement about their view of Hillary Clinton. And so
I think it's probably both of those things. And I think that the additional showing of some of the down ticket candidates in the primary mm-hmm. may have been contributed to by, you know, it could have been that a Republican voter asked for a Democratic ballot yesterday.
Yeah. I mean, I just following my Facebook feed, I'm friends with a lot of Vermonters on Facebook, and it just struck me as you know, wow, so-and-so supports Buttigieg, you know, so-and-so supports, is a big Klobuchar backer, and who knew, you know? It would not surprise me at all that some of those folks would have said, I'm working Tuesday, I'm going to go vote early, you know, I have to be in the downtown of my town near the town clerk's office, you know, a week ahead of time, I'll go in and vote. And boy, that, you know, there is a danger there. And I think some folks maybe have some buyer's remorse this morning. But, you know, again, that's just the way it unfolds sometimes. So very, very interesting stuff. Now, going forward, I mean, let's imagine kind of roll this, we're looking at the crystal ball about the convention. Is it going to be as tight, do you think, as it was with Sanders and Clinton 4 years ago? Or do you think that Biden has really now got this momentum that's going to carry him forward and he's going to be the guy for the rest of the way, pretty much?
Oh, no, I don't think that's the case. I think that, you know, I think that Bernie is going to keep a certain amount of momentum. He needed California to kind of clinch it yesterday as far as, you know, making sure that his delegate count was in good standing.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the most part, he can, that puts him well ahead. But I think what we're going to see going into the convention is that the Democratic Party is going to be very divided across the nation between what they want from a more traditional Democrat, a.k.a. Joe Biden, and what they want from and what the revolution, as Bernie would call it, how that manifests itself through him as a candidate. That division is, I fear, going to have to really duke it out at the convention. It's different this time because, as you point out, it doesn't come down to, I can't stand Hillary. There are a fair number of people who do like Joe Biden and can tolerate Joe Biden and think that Joe Biden would make a good president. It's not the same kind of, I can't vote for Hillary.
Yeah. I don't know why, you know, what it came from really exactly, but I mean, I could sort of speculate on that too, but just a lot of real, some distaste. And it's not just that she's a woman. I think, because a lot of folks don't have the same visceral reaction to, Elizabeth Warren, let's say. They might disagree with her position on the political spectrum, being, fairly liberal, far left, or whatever you want to call it. But they don't have the same sort of, I'm not sure exactly what it was that Hillary Clinton, this feature of her personality or something that really drove a lot of people away. Sad to say for her, and maybe for the Democratic Party, since they nominated her in 2016. Anyway, Steve Pappas, I want to let our listeners know, remind them that they are welcome to call in and check in with us and tell us what they're thinking. 244-1777 is the number here at WDEV in Waterbury. And Steve Pappas is my guest. He's the editor and publisher of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald. Let's talk a little bit about, were there any striking results from town meetings last night? Or it seems like all the budgets in your area pretty much passed, and that the Granite City voters just say yes. For instance, the Barry coverage in the Times Argus this morning, that's the headline: Barry school budget passes test. I think I saw a headline saying that the Montpelier also approved both its municipal and school budgets yesterday. I saw the Harwood school budget went down. That's, of course, our local school district here. We're located in Waterbury, and what do you make of that, Steve? Do you think that is really purely a financial thing, or is that a sort of protest against some of what's going on in the school district in terms of their consolidation plans, or what? Any thoughts there?
That's exactly what it was a protest vote against that consolidation program proposal, because there was nothing. The budget that was presented to voters was not terribly out of line with what they've had in the past. And what happened in Harwood is exactly what officials in Barrie were afraid was going to happen last night. They were actually in Barrie. They were bracing to start the campaign today on how to convince voters that when the budget failed epically, they thought it was going to fail badly, that they could basically, convince people that this was a good idea. It happened in Harwood. It sounded like going into town meeting season, that was pretty inevitable. It sounded like there were a lot of people over there who really do not like this consolidation plan of moving the students from the schools and what that meant for potential job security for certain folks. I mean, it turned into a very high emotion kind of situation, and this definitely buys the voters a little more time to kind of leverage their position with the school board and the superintendent over there to convince them that this is not the direction that they want to go. So I took it very much as a protest vote.
Yeah, that's there's been a fair amount of protests going on in the Harwood district, and It's a tough time, I think, for the towns trying to figure out the way forward in terms of just the demographics of the school district and also trying to figure out, you know, how do they keep things affordable for taxpayers while at the same time maintain what I think has been a lot of care and feeding and love for that local school district in Waterbury and the Mad River Valley over the years. I mean, Harwood's always had a good reputation as a high school, and they're trying to figure out a way forward post Act 46, and many other districts around Vermont are in similar straits. This is really the first town meeting day after the dust settled. You know, the State Board of Education made its final merger orders to various communities, and of course, there's been litigation since then. But not
for Harwood.
No, that's true.
And for Harwood, they had already gone through this cycle once.
Yeah. Yep.
So, and again, that to me, that's a signal of not liking, you know, the direction that they're going. And really, that's the only recourse at this point that voters had. I mean, this stopped the process and forces everybody to start over. And it's kind of up to the officials now to decide what they're going to present as an alternative. Now, conversely, Montpelier several years ago, Montpelier is notorious for moving students around from one building to another,
mm-hmm.
Based on class sizes. Now, that's a little bit different because it's all confined to one community, but you know, it comes down to the superintendent and the school officials talking about what is the cost effectiveness of, you know, moving a class to a different place where it can be, you know, better utilized and your class sizes are manageable and all of that. That makes perfect sense. But it becomes a much more high stakes game when you're talking about pulling kids out of school, putting them on buses, moving them for long periods of time to a different school. That feels like more of an affront, and that's what's happened in Harwood. I think that's what you're going to see happening in some of the other Act 46 consolidated school districts as well, including possibly Washington Central in the coming years, as enrollments shift in those communities like Worcester and Callis and other places. And that, unfortunately, is the name of the game now, because unless Act 46 is repealed or the Vermont Supreme Court decides that it is not constitutional, this is the way forward.
Yeah. Hey, I just noticed on Facebook a post from a guest on the show from yesterday. Lisa Scalotti is a longtime Vermont journalist, is now teaching some journalism at the University of Vermont. And she put up a post saying, I love voting in Vermont. She lives in Waterbury here. She said, I love voting in Vermont where your friend and her state representative husband, that refers to Liz Schlegel and Tom Stevens, the state rep from Waterbury, no line in just 15 minutes from when I arrived to when I was driving away. I voted and chatted with 9 people, including town clerks and one candidate. Very grateful, especially afterwards seeing people in Texas waiting over 5 hours to vote. And that just brings to mind a very interesting thing that I think deserves saying here, which is that big kudos to our town clerks, our boards of civil authority, all the people who volunteer to turn out at their town and city halls in Vermont to help out on election night. It's a big project to count votes in any state, including Vermont. And these folks really put in a lot of work. They take it very, very seriously. They do it with a lot of integrity and efficiency. And hats off is what I'm saying. And of course, Secretary of State Jim Condos, who kind of is the top election official in Vermont that leads the way, is going to be my guest in the second half hour of the program this morning. We're looking forward to speaking with him. But Steve, I mean, just reflect on that for a minute, if you would, compared to the 5-hour lines you see in some other states, what goes on in Vermont here.
Absolutely. I mean, it would not happen. We would not have it all be work as efficiently as it does. And you have to consider that the mandates that are being put on a lot of these clerks, or have been put on the clerks over you know, decades now, some of these long-standing clerks have seen tremendous amounts of changes and more on their workload through, you know, federal or state mandates, and yet they are the frontline person for a lot of the goings on in town government and basically running the show, making sure that everything is working efficiently, including these very complicated elections. They're, you know, the elections themselves are not complicated, but it's a tremendous amount of setup, making sure the ballots are ready, making, you know, hitting all these deadlines, making sure the reports are all done on time, making sure the town report gets printed. It's, you know, you're not kidding. It is a tremendous amount of work. And
that's why I say we should all be thankful that we have folks who are willing to step up and do that
for sure.
Yeah. Hey, we're fast approaching the bottom of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Steve Pappas has been my guest this first half hour. Steve, as always, it's great to have you on the air with us, and appreciate your insights, and we'll be doing this again soon, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care, Dave.
All righty. We are going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors. I believe we're going to be hearing shortly from Secretary of State Jim Condos. He's going to be calling us in a few minutes, I hope. That's the plan anyway. And meanwhile, we'll be back in a few, folks. Stay with us.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Continuing into the second half hour of our program this Wednesday morning, March the 4th, 2020, the day after Town Meeting Day and Super Tuesday here in Vermont, a big day for anybody who's involved in running an election, and somebody who's overseeing elections statewide probably had a very busy day yesterday. I'm thinking there about Secretary of State Jim Condos, who's kind enough to get on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning, Dave.
Thank you so much for joining me. I wanted to check in a couple of things. One was, I'm hearing that it was a very high turnout yesterday. Do you know anything about that?
We haven't got the final numbers in yet, but I can tell you by looking at the last few elections this morning, I came in and actually 2016, we had about 197,000 voters that voted. In the presidential primary, both Democrat and Republican. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, we're right now at 196. We still have one town that's out. Numbers are out, so we don't know for sure. We think it might surpass the 2016. We're probably going to surpass the 2016. And that would probably be a record. I've only looked back to 2000, so...
A record for this millennium, right?
What's that?
A record for this millennium, possibly.
Possibly.
Yeah. Well, that's kudos to Vermont voters for getting out there and doing their civic duty and so on. Speaking of voters, some number, and I don't know if you have exact numbers here, but actually went and cast their ballots early. And I saw a story yesterday, very interesting story yesterday. I was perusing Fox News website, and they had a story about folks out in California being a little having some buyer's remorse, I guess, because they voted early and they voted for people like Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg in the Democratic primaries. And of course, Sunday and Monday, those two candidates ended their campaigns, endorsed Joe Biden, and. I'm just wondering, it looks like a similar phenomenon may have unfolded here in Vermont, where about, I think, Buttigieg and Klobuchar, when I was checking last night, had attracted about 6,000 votes between them here in the state. And I'm thinking to myself, that's got to be, I can't imagine anybody coming in Tuesday to vote for them. Some folks were voting early. Am I reading that right so far?
Well, I don't know that you can actually say the 6,000 were voted early. Believe it or not, a lot of people don't watch the news, So,
oh, come on. You mean
I know that that probably hurt you, Dave, but it is true that a lot of people just don't pay attention until they actually walk into the polling place. But if I could just back up for 1 second.
Sure.
We first have to remember that the right to vote is a constitutionally protected right, and we have a responsibility as Secretary of State and Chief Elections Officer to ensure that every eligible Vermonter maintains their right to vote, mm-hmm. regardless of whether or not they can make it to the polls or not. We also have a 2009 MOVE Act, Military and Overseas Voters Act, that was enacted by Congress that mandates that we have the ballots ready and mailed out by the 45th day before the election to overseas and military voters. So we, Vermont, back in 2009, decided that if it was good enough for our military and overseas voters, then it was good enough for all voters to have that time. It's one of the most generous in the country. We have some states that don't have early voting. We have some states that have very restricted early voting, and Vermont's one of the most lenient as far as giving people plenty of time. Second thing I would say is once you fill your ballot out and hand it to the clerk, in other words, you can fill out a ballot at home and sit on it. Mm-hmm. Once you hand it to the clerk, it now is in the clerk's custody, no longer is in your custody. So that's where the if you want to call it the line of demarcation, is once that clerk has received your ballot. Up to that point, if you still have it, you could walk into City Hall or Town Hall and request, say, look, I filled this out, but I want to change my vote. Can I have a new ballot? And you give them your old ballot, they'll give you a new ballot.
I see. Okay. But once you actually fill it out and hand it in, that is, you've done the deed, and there's no pulling that back, right?
No, there is no pulling that back. And I think that's pretty much the way it is across the country. I don't know of any state that does it any differently.
At some point, you got to make the decision. And so,
right. But here's the other thing,
yep.
David, and I think this is an important point to remember. There are lots of cases, even here in Vermont, where a candidate passes away or pulls out of an election just before. I don't have examples right now, but I can do the research. But or someone pulls out of a race before either the primary or the general election, so people have that situation develop. But also think about it from the standpoint. How do you think the voters of Iowa feel right now? Because they caucused and supported Pete Buttigieg, and now he's out of the race. Three primaries later, he's out of the race. It's almost like they had the whole state was their vote was wasted, if you want to call it. But it's not. It's still your opportunity to make your case, to voice your support for a particular type of candidate.
No, I agree with that. I just wonder whether as a voter who's sort of trying to strategize and on an individual voter basis, I could see somebody saying to themselves, I mean, if they really wanted to kind of think about this and have the potential dropout factor weigh heavily on their decision about when to vote and for whom to vote and so on, it probably, if somebody were going to vote a week early, let's say last Tuesday, I guess that would have been the 25th of February, and they were looking at the ballot and saying to themselves, okay, there've been some calls already for some of these moderates to drop out. You're hearing a lot of chatter in the media, when is Amy Klobuchar going to drop out and et cetera, but I really like Amy Klobuchar. I'm thinking about voting for her. It might be a somewhat different calculus, I would think, in that individual voter's mind than if the voter is a big Bernie Sanders supporter. It's a pretty safe bet if you're looking at it on February 25th that Bernie Sanders is still going to be in the race on March 4th.
Yeah. So, I think what we saw in the early vote tallies is that we kind of we look at it pretty much every other day. leading up until the last probably 10 days or so, and then we look at it every day. But what we saw was the requests for ballots were up, but the return of those ballots was down. And it didn't start catching up until really the last week, and specifically Monday. I mean, we had a lot of ballots that came in on Monday to the town clerks. So, you know, I mean, for instance, this year we had about a 30% increase in early vote ballots over 2016.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty significant increase, 30% increase over 2016,
yeah.
Which in itself had a rather contentious fight going on between Hillary and Bernie, even though Bernie won the state. But also on the other side, you had several candidates for president on the Republican ticket in 2016. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look at the numbers of the ballots that came back, the percentage is actually pretty much leveled off, and it'll be a few more days before we actually have better numbers, because sometimes the clerks just don't have time as they're getting ready for election day. So, it appears that the returned ballots pretty much leveled off and came back in where we thought they would. And it's a pretty significant increase. I'd be wrong if I didn't say this, but I do want to say thank you to all of our town clerks and city clerks across the state who worked very hard, to ensure the integrity of our elections. The citizens of Vermont owe them a debt of gratitude for the amount of work that they put in. Many of the town clerks are in their offices on election day before 5 a.m., and they don't go home until after midnight in most cases.
Yeah, I was giving the big kudos just before the bottom of the hour break here before you came on, and I don't know if you heard, but I was talking about the clerks and the town volunteers, the various members of the boards of civil authority and so on, the folks out there who are actually, who are staffing the table when you go to register to check in at the voting place. And, those folks are deserve to have their friends buy them a cup of coffee or something today.
I would ask anybody that talks to their town clerk today, mm-hmm. say thank you.
Yeah.
Because they do a tremendous amount of work. You know, I walked around and thanked my own election staff here this morning for the work that they did yesterday. They were here at 6 in the morning, and they didn't go home until around midnight last night. It's always a good thing, David, when a reporter calls me up and says, "So how's the day been?" And I go, "Pretty smooth," and that's a great feeling to be able to say.
That's great. Hey, let me ask you, get your thoughts if you have a few more minutes about the just the outcome yesterday and so on. One remarkable thing I noticed was that 1986 the support for Bernie Sanders in Vermont was 86%. Of course, he was in that two-person race basically against Hillary Clinton. I don't remember if there were others.
You mean 2016?
Yeah, 2016. I'm sorry. In 2016, Bernie Sanders got 86% of the vote against Hillary Clinton. This time, he just got barely over 50. A rather low number compared to even his Senate races and House races and so on in Vermont. What explains that big drop off? Do you think?
Well, I think it's frankly I'm a little bit at a loss as to why, but I wasn't surprised when people were asking me before Tuesday that what did I think, and I said he's not going to match the 85 or 86%
because yeah.
Just the sheer number of candidates that are out there, and the interest that we saw in the early vote tallies and whatever. So I kind of understood that. And it's really, I think the better people to ask would be some of the folks that you have talked to in the past, political science professors than it is me. My job is not really to speculate. It's really more to administer the elections.
Yeah, I understand. It is a fascinating kind of change in the picture, though. I'm going to speculate for a moment here. In 2016, he was 74. This year, he's 78. That's when you get up into that age bracket, that's a difference, I guess.
You're not going to get me involved in that discussion.
Okay, all right.
I do think that it's. People always ask me what drives the voter turnout, mm-hmm. and I always say it's the candidates or the issues. If you look South Burlington, for instance, the city of South Burlington, we haven't got the final numbers yet, but my understanding is that they in at least one, maybe two polling places, they ran out of ballots for local issues. So the local issues, and they had that huge school bond that was on there and their school budget. So those two drove a lot of folks to the polls, but they also had a contested city council race that also drove people to the polls.
Sure.
And I think though it still comes down to the candidates or the issues that are on the ballot. In 2016 you had Hillary and Bernie, and I think that there was a certain. People knew both, and they made a conscious choice. This time, because we saw that lag in the returns of early ballots, we thought people were holding on to make their choices. But you still had, Bernie was still on the ticket. He still won decisively. I mean, I think Joe Biden came in at like 22% or something. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at the numbers yet, but it was less than half of what Bernie had.
Yep.
So I think it's still pretty decisive. But again, you had sheer numbers and nothing else on the ballot. So I think it's really the speculation. Go talk to the political science professors. I think you get a better feel for it.
Yeah, I get you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot there. When you look around the country, I'm seeing a lot of complaints online about long, hours long waits at polls, polling places around the country, and so on. Of course, there are places with much bigger populations than Vermont, places that have seen huge growth spurts in their populations, and sometimes those are administrative nightmares for an election official just to try to keep up with the influx of new people, new registrants, and so on and so forth. But I read this post earlier just before the break, and I'm going to read it to you again, Secretary Condos, because I think it really kind of tells you a little bit of a story about Vermont. My friend Lisa Scalotti, who lives in Waterbury, she was actually a guest on the program yesterday. She's a longtime Vermont journalist, now teaching kids at UVM journalism, and had a team deployed to cover town meeting yesterday, and she posts on Facebook. She says, "I love voting in Vermont, where your friend and her state rep husband greet you to check you in." This, of course, was Liz Schlegel and Tom Stevens, the state rep from Waterbury. There's a picture here of them. "No line in just 15 minutes from when I arrived to when I was driving away." That's Lisa Scalotti talking. She says, "I voted and chatted with 9 people, including town clerks and one candidate. Very grateful, especially afterwards, seeing people in Texas waiting over 5 hours to vote." Is there any way to get this Vermont elixir of efficiency and smooth sailing on Election Day into a bottle and ship it to places like Texas?
Well, as you know, David, I was the president of my national association, and I have used and continue to use my bully pulpit to talk to the media nationally, as well as in Vermont, but nationally, and to talk to my colleagues about the practices, the best practices that Vermont has instituted and implemented that make us a real beacon in the eyes of democracy.
Yeah, give me the 2 or 3 things, if you were to say to folks in Texas or really anywhere around the country, that Vermont is doing that they ought to adopt it to make their elections run more smoothly, what would they be?
Well, the first thing I would say is really what we consider to be our gold standard. It's a non-technological solution to the cybersecurity attacks and that is paper ballots. It makes sure you have paper ballots for every vote that's cast. We seal those, the town clerks seal those paper ballots into bags and store them in their vaults for 22 months so they're available if needed for a recount or for audits. Second thing I would do is say that every district should do a every state should do post-election audits with a high statistical confidence level. We've been doing them here in Vermont in since 2006, and we've stepped up our game and are doing more and more each year. So those are the first two things I would do. And then to just engage the public, to be open and transparent, and ensure that make it easy for people to vote, harder for people to cheat, to make sure that your systems work, do the legwork, the homework, before you adopt a new system to make sure that it's going to be what you need. But, we've just this past week, I think it was, or 10 days, we had a team from, the state of Iowa that was here, looking at our election management system and we are looked on by my colleagues across the country as one of the premier states in voter access.
Yeah, that is a, kudos to Vermont, I guess, is one way to describe this. I'm a little shy about being just a complete booster here, but it makes a big difference. And I do think that it is one more reason for people to be glad to live here and feel like they are, this is a still functioning democracy we've got up here in this little corner of the world. So Secretary of State Jim Condos has been my guest. I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's good chatting with you.
Thank you, David. Have a good week.
All right, you too. We are fast approaching the top of the hour. We're going to go to some CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors. Then our good friend Bob Nail will be joining us. He's doing some analysis of election results this morning, and we'll be checking in with him, followed by Linda Fowler. She's a political science professor at Dartmouth College. So we get some more good conversations coming up here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Stick around, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Continuing into the second hour of our program on this Wednesday, March the 4th, 2020. Glad to say that Bob Nay, a frequent guest on the Dave Graham Show over the couple of years I've been doing this, is back with us this morning to give us a little bit of analysis of the yesterday's Super Tuesday results. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Dave. Analysis is wow.
Wow.
What analysis?
Define wow.
Well, wow is complicated. First of all, let's go to Elizabeth Warren. I mean, I was trying to envision this morning, what would one say, you know, if you're Elizabeth Warren? Would you say, I just lost my home state where I was the United States Senator, but it's off to another state. We're going to win. You know, I can't imagine what scenario she could come up with. I think it also stops her chances of being a VP, you know, candidate. It's a big loss if you lose your home state. So I think, you know, she's done. We obviously saw this week, just because of the Nevada and South Carolina primaries, because it's a Super Tuesday, we saw also Buttigieg and Klobuchar and Tom Steyer all leave.
Mm-hmm.
Bloomberg's done. I don't care what anybody says. You know, he won American Samoa. And as I said with tongue-in-cheek on my Facebook account yesterday, he bought everybody a boat, a house, and promised to never return if he was elected president. So, you know, there was a financial incentive there.
Yeah.
But he's a kingmaker. And we know who he's a kingmaker for. You know it, and I know it.
Mm-hmm.
Biden's big day.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the rap on Biden so far during this primary campaign had been that he seemed to have lost a step and just a little bit. Showing his age, frankly, I guess is
right.
the most polite way to say it.
Right.
Do you feel like he has gained some new focus just, you know, within his own personal self here, or what is going on with him?
Yes, you know, the brain is a fascinating entity. It really is. It controls a lot, and it has its moments where it goes down and up, and something like this, the big victory, and I watched his speech closely, it might just, you know, have sharpened, you know, all his skills because, you know, I served with Joe Biden, Dave. I've been in meetings with him, public and private, and he was one of the sharpest people ever. And then he had these stumbles along the way. And, of course, friends of mine say, well, so does Donald Trump. Well, Trump may, but, you know, Biden still has got to be the nominee, and people are going to look at that. So, but I think he sort of got a new energy, don't you?
It seems that way, and you know, for the if you're a Democrat, you have to hope so because you don't want to see that end up being a deficit if he ends up being the nominee and is running, you know, in a general election in a very very what's going to be a very very tough campaign with Donald Trump, obviously. The other thing that may scare some people about Biden a bit is that. Certainly the Republicans have been, you know, maybe they've seen this coming all along. And you know, Donald Trump, I think, was betting on him being the nominee when he was trying to get dirt on Biden from the president of Ukraine. But there is all this talk about Burisma and that whole episode of, you know, what the right-wing media like to talk about is Biden's corruption and so on. Is this going to stick to him like the emails did to Hillary in 2016?
It will depend. That's a great question, by the way, because I'll answer that a couple of ways. It'll depend on how he handles it, because you can take similarities between President Trump and Joe Biden. Really, really, you can. You know, when they talk about corruption, talk about their children that benefit from public office. I mean, you can go down the list and say, oh, yeah. Biden, oh yes, Trump. I mean, to
yeah, check him off.
This, yep. Yeah, check him off. So having said that, I think it's how Biden handles it, because if Biden lets the press pin him down and go after him only and lets Trump have, you know, sort of a pass because Trump ignores them, then Biden could get quite caught up. He's got to stay focused on what he's about, what he's going to offer. You know, minority voters and moderates turned big for Biden is what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
And so he's got to, you know, kind of stay focused. But then again, I mean, we're talking like he's the nominee, but there's a double-edged sword here. Bernie Sanders is breathing right down his back, and now it's a Sanders-Biden deal. And the other question is, how is Bernie Sanders handled if he's not the nominee? And Bernie could be the nominee, by the way. I mean, I'm not ruling that out at all.
Oh, sure.
This isn't over with. This
yep.
is a horse race. But if Bernie's not the nominee, what can Biden do, and how does he handle Bernie, and how does he treat Bernie? Does he want a whole scenario that happened to Hillary Clinton last election? Not just the emails, but the scenario of, you know, people not being so, you know, enthused about her, and some people stayed away at the polls.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the big question a couple of weeks ago from Chuck Todd at the debate was in Nevada was whether the candidates would support a nomination of somebody who came in with a plurality of delegates.
Uh-huh.
Right now, Joe Biden has the plurality lead, correct?
Yes, he does.
And so, I mean, all of a sudden that question kind of turns around again on Bernie Sanders to some extent. And I wonder if he's willing to say, and emphatically so, that, listen, you know, I was pushing for that plurality number just, you know, as of mid-February of 2020. I believe that's the way it ought to go. And if Joe Biden ends up emerging as the winner there, we all need to really get behind him because, obviously, you know, as Bernie Sanders has been saying throughout, the most important job here is defeating Donald Trump. So,
right. Exactly.
I think that would be a role it would be, I think, almost forced on Bernie Sanders to really become a cheerleader. Now, I personally think that the damage Sanders allegedly did to Clinton in 2016 has been way overplayed, including by her. The most damage done to that candidacy of Hillary Clinton was done by Hillary Clinton.
But I agree 100% with that. Absolutely.
Do you think if it's close, that there's a danger here that you'll alienate the Sanders people, or are they going to be alienated if the guy loses no matter what? Or would it be better for the Democrats to have a clear victory? I mean, let's assume for a moment that Biden does emerge as the nominee. Would it be a better thing for the Democrats to have him have even a majority of delegates or a strong plurality over Sanders, and that way you can go into the convention saying he won fair and square?
Well, he could, but there's a lot of things going on right now that I see, and a lot of it's open, by the way, with direct interference it's a political way of life. I won't call it interference, but direct agitation at Bernie Sanders by the Democratic establishment. Mm-hmm. And some of my friends aren't being shy about it. They are outright saying that the Democrat National Committee has to stop Sanders or the whole party's going to be slaughtered. Now, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that. But I'm just saying what is going on. So even if Joe Biden enters, again, it could be Sanders, but if he enters with the plurality, and it helps him. But the bottom line is, how will Sanders react if he doesn't get the nomination, and how can he guide his people to help Joe Biden? I think that's a biggie. And I agree with you, though, on Hillary Clinton. I mean, Bernie Sanders didn't make her stay out of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and didn't make her talk about deplorables, and didn't make her make those speeches at Goldman Sachs that she wouldn't release the contents of. And there's a long list. Right. Bernie Sanders, let's say something in his defense for a moment. Let's assume that he's the nominee. I was talking to a political science professor from one of our colleges up here on Monday, Trish Siplon of St. Michael's College, and she thinks that Sanders has a good chance of doing what he's talked about, which is to sort of unleash this movement of people who don't normally vote. Remember, about half the country typically doesn't show up in our elections in recent years. And then all of a sudden you would have this groundswell of support come out of nowhere for Bernie Sanders in a general election that hasn't even shown up in the primary, because primaries tend to attract the more regularly politically involved and so on. Do you think there's anything there, or is that a complete pipe dream?
No, I think there's something potentially there. And, I tell my Republican friends, and when they ask my opinion, and I say, if you think that you're just going to, if it's Bernie Sanders, it's done, he's a Democrat socialist, he's a communist, blah, 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 I said, you better take a second look. This is going to be a tight race. And then on the same hand of my Democratic friends who say, Donald Trump's this and that, and I say, well, if you just think he's done, and then no matter who runs against him that he's done, I said, you better think again. So my look at this goes out to both parties the same way. I think these are going to be horse races. And that professor you talked about, she could be correct, because of all the candidates, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders can turn out more people than any other candidate that stood on those stages or would stand on those stages.
I'll tell you, as a reporter, longtime journalist, I think it would be certainly exciting and entertaining and maybe clarifying for the country to have somebody who's a quote unquote Democratic socialist up against somebody who has been, shall we say, the who has pushed the edges of capitalism in his business life and so on. That would be a fascinating showdown for sure. So,
well, and let me throw this out here too.
Yep.
The economy, the Fed, dropped, as we know, the rates, and it was like they pulled the fire alarm and didn't tell anybody why. We don't know why. And, if in September.
Bob Ney, my guest on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. We seem to have lost Bob, but a headline just popped up on my iPad here in the WDEV studio. It says Michael Bloomberg is dropping out of the 2020 primary race for the Democratic nomination. And gee whiz, a $500 million ego trip, maybe? I don't know. That has to have been about the most expensive vacation on record. Wow. Ugh. Okay. Bye-bye, Michael Bloomberg. And maybe he's going to make a trip to American Samoa, where they apparently like him. They actually gave him support yesterday in the Super Tuesday primaries. And so, gee whiz. Well, let's try to recover from that shocking news that Michael Bloomberg would withdraw from the race. And bring in our next guest, who is Linda Fowler. She's a political science professor at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I'm sure has been watching closely all of the developments in the Democratic primaries here, the Super Tuesday primaries of yesterday. Good morning, Professor Fowler. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, hi, Dave. I've been looking at the exit polls, and I've really never seen anything quite like this in all my years at looking at primaries.
What strikes you most about the exit polls you're seeing?
Just how quickly things changed from a week ago when everybody thought Biden was probably going to drop out after Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
And some, you know, shockers off the top of my head that Elizabeth Warren didn't carry her home state. That Sanders, who looked like he was going to be very strong and potentially in Virginia, North Carolina, really didn't do well. So he's going to come out quite well in terms of delegates because of California. But the other, that it's hard to read California right now because there were so many mailed-in ballots that people were waiting until the actual day. And the timing of the suspension of the Klobuchar and Buttigieg campaigns may have influenced people's decisions. If last time I was on this show, I think we were talking about Bernie's fortunes, and I said we won't know until it gets down to a two-person race.
Yep.
And now here we are.
It does seem to be that way. And, you know, I think we're also talking about the fact that it looked like in the early going, Iowa, New Hampshire, even Nevada, that Bernie Sanders was advantaged by the fact that there were several moderates in the race who were pretty much dividing up the moderate vote, and you know, leaving him to emerge as the winner. You know, basically sort of like 25% to a bunch of 20s, or less. You know, and it looks like the moderate vote is now coalescing around Joe Biden. Is that a fair read of yesterday?
Yeah, I think even if you looked at the early contest, Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, it was the case that adding Elizabeth Warren's votes and Bernie's votes together, there still wasn't a majority. But if you added the so-called moderates together, that's where the majority of the party was. And I think it's very interesting that that Bernie worked really hard with African-American voters in the South. He was there a lot. You know, he has an exemplary civil rights record. But I think it just didn't pay off for him. And it's pretty hard to claim that you're, you know, representing a revolution when the party's most loyal supporters are saying, well we don't want one.
Yeah, isn't that weird? I mean, it's sort of, okay, well, I guess maybe the large African-American vote that is a linchpin of the Democratic coalition certainly is not as sort of, I don't know, left progressive as some people might have imagined.
Well, that's the thing that's interesting. They show in past public opinion polls, they show up as being among the most liberal voters in terms of the role of government and health care and so forth. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be very cautious this time. And there seems to be a real determination that they're not going to sit this election out the way they did in 2016. I think the other thing that's interesting is I remember thinking when Klobuchar and Buttigieg dropped out and immediately endorsed Biden, and then Beto did, O'Rourke from Texas did as well. Had the Republicans done that at the same stages of campaign, instead of fighting it out through April, Donald Trump would not have gotten the nomination. Because it wasn't till the end that he really started women winning primaries. But the anti-Trump vote was split all over the map with Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and so forth. And had those Republicans sort of made the same kind of calculation that we need to put the interests of the party ahead of our own personal interests, we'd have a different person in the White House. Now, some people might think that's a bad thing. Some people might think it was a good thing. But it's very interesting that the Democrats, who have a reputation, what is it when the Democrats form a firing squad, they make a circle?
Yeah, right.
And for whatever reason, maybe it was a mix of altruism and self-interest, but for whatever reason, what happened on Monday night in Texas was really extraordinary.
Yeah, that I wonder, Beto O'Rourke, I mean, Sanders was in some of the polls, was a little bit ahead in Texas. Looked like he was going to be at least really strong there. Biden ends up emerging with the victory in Texas. Do you think the Beto O'Rourke endorsement made that difference?
No, I don't. I think there's an emerging suburban Democratic electorate in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the predicate for Sanders doing well there was that he did so well with Latino voters in Nevada.
Yeah.
And I think there was a presumption that the same thing might happen in Texas. But Nevada was a caucus, and Texas was a primary. So I think they maybe overestimated Sanders' appeal among Latinos, widely speaking. It's really hard to talk about a Latino vote. You know, some Hispanic some people with Hispanic roots are Cuban. Some are from Mexico and have been in the country for hundreds of years.
Sure. Yeah, that's true.
Some are from Guatemala and El Salvador.
It's a diverse group, for sure.
Yeah, it's very diverse. And I think that pundits make the mistake often of sort of lumping everybody together.
Let's bring in a listener. I believe Rama's on the line from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Morning, guys. Hey, yeah, I just want to say, you know, two things really stood out for me on yesterday. And one is that huge majorities came out and said that they really wanted something like single-payer health care. There is no doubt that the flagship issue for Sanders, that, you know, Medicare for All, is extremely, extremely popular. The other flip side is, and this is something I called in about a few days ago, Dave, was that, you know, there's this dynamic. People are looking to beat Trump. And that's something that's got to be factored into all of this. And you can take all their people's issues and you can say, okay, that's going to count for 40% of the vote. 60% is going to be who do we honestly believe we can be, that can beat Trump. The unfortunate side of this is that there is a group in the Democratic Party who have it in for Sanders. They're out to get him. They want to keep him out of out of party business as much as possible. And it's going to be very tough if the Democratic Party keeps attacking Sanders as some outsider. It's not going to help them in the long run. It may get Biden nominated. It may not necessarily get Biden nominated. But if Biden does get nominated under hostile circumstances within the party like that, we've got four more years of that narcissistic, lying, misogynist, racist pig down in the White House that we have right now.
Tell us how you feel, Rhonda.
You know, well, that's exactly what's going to happen here. So, you know, if they really want to push Biden, that's fine. That's the, you know, people have every right to push whoever they think they want to push. But they better darn well be aware of the fact that you can't drive away the same people who you're going to depend on to vote for Biden.
All right, Rhonda, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's bring in Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, you know, I listen to Joe and all his, you know, what he talks about with them, but I haven't figured out how Joe is going to have a policy that's going to increase the productivity of the marketplace and therefore make the GDP get higher and make my 401k get bigger and my paycheck get bigger. Can you figure that one out?
No. I mean, I don't know. I don't have a real handle exactly on what his monetary and fiscal policies are right now. I'll have to study up on that a little bit. And
he doesn't have any. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, how about you guess? Can she discover a fiscal policy that Joe might have?
You know, I actually think also.
I think
go ahead, Linda Fowler.
Well, I think part of it is going to be sort of rebalancing expenditures and revenues. Biden has been somebody who said that the long-term health of the economy means that we've got to do something about having these peacetime deficits when unemployment is so low, and we're undermining the full faith and credit of the government. Now, it's odd that a Democrat is saying that, but in fact, that's what a lot of Democrats are saying.
Got to go to a bottom of the hour break. Bring back John Maynard Keynes. We'll be back with more with Linda Fowler in just a couple of minutes, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra, long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Linda Fowler is my guest. She's a professor of political science at Dartmouth College over in Hanover, New Hampshire, and is a longtime observer of politics on both sides of the river as well as nationally. And you were saying, we were talking about Joe Biden's monetary and fiscal policy just before the break, and I think that the caller, Fred from Newbury, was asking about it, and it's safe to say that we would probably go back to a more Obama-esque approach.
With promises of modest growth. In effect, we've had the same kind of growth under Trump that we had under Obama, but without the deficits. And in terms of other kind of fiscal policies, the idea is to expand the Obamacare coverage, but without going to a full federally funded program, which again is constrained by the huge deficits we have already. We're running a trillion-dollar deficit this year, and
yeah.
I think a lot of people think it's just not sustainable over time. But then there are sort of the traditional things: job training, development of R&D, solar energy. You know, developing solar and wind power and so forth to cut energy costs. So nothing terribly radical, but sort of policies that a lot of voters seem to be pretty comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried at all about two of the negatives that attach to Biden? One of them, his age and just general, you know, sharpness and ability to keep his speech focused, et cetera. Let's start with that one.
Okay. Yeah, I do worry about that. I think Bernie's too old. I think Biden's too old. I think Trump is too old.
Mm-hmm.
And I speak as somebody who's not quite their age, but getting close enough to look at myself and think, should I be president? The answer is no. And I'm a lot more articulate than either Trump or Biden. I think Biden's malapropisms have been something that he was prone to when he was in his 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And he does suffer from a speech impediment. And certainly when he's up against a debate champion, Elizabeth Warren or Amy Klobuchar, who's very sharp on her feet, or Pete Buttigieg, you know, who's got some extraordinarily articulate Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Misspeaking when he's up against Trump, who doesn't seem to know how to pronounce coronavirus and some other sorts of things, it may not be as evident.
I was thinking about a possible new name for the coronavirus. I think this COVID-19 thing is just a little too, laboratory-esque. What about Covfefe? just a suggestion. I don't know where I came up with that.
Wednesday morning, why not?
It starts with a cove, you know, and I think, well, let's go with Covfefe. I just think that would be a little more like, right. I don't know, dengue or something, or, you know. Oh, my word. So, yeah, I just think that a Biden-Trump general election will be just such great material for the cold opens on Saturday Night Live. That's the
I'm afraid so.
I try to look at the bright side.
Well, I'd like to go back. I don't know if you have a caller waiting, but I'd
not
like
yet.
To go back to something that your previous caller said about if Biden wins the nomination because everybody piles on Bernie Sanders and alienates him and his supporters, that would be harmful. And I think that is a very worthwhile caution. Things are different now for Sanders than they were in 2016. First of all, I think the party organization, the DNC, really has been neutral in a way that they weren't with Hillary. Mm-hmm. Secondly, Sanders got the kind of rules about delegate allocation that he wanted. He pushed hard at the DNC to diminish the power of the superdelegates. They don't get to vote until after the first round. He pushed hard to have proportional, instead of winner-take-all states, to have delegates awarded proportionally. So I don't think he has a lot to complain about compared to last time. But it is the case that a lot of people who've been loyal Democrats are acutely aware that A, he's not a Democrat, and B, that he doesn't seem to have, he doesn't seem to be very mindful that if he's at the top of the ticket, he may cost Democrats in the Senate and the House a reasonable chance of winning competitive seats. And
why is that? What is that sort of negative coattail effect I keep hearing about?
Well, a part of it is because of his behavior when he's been in Congress and the Senate. He's a loner. That's mm-hmm. part of his appeal. He speaks truth to power. He has few friends in Washington. That's what a lot of people like about him. But it also means when he's head of the party, he's not going to do anything to strengthen the party as a whole, and that's going to mean that he can't govern. So,
well, I'll tell you, one of my chief
substance to those fears.
One of my chief criticisms of President Obama was that he did, it seemed, not very much, not as much as Trump, frankly, in terms of getting members of his own party elected to Congress. I mean, it seemed like he was pretty quiet in 2010 and 2014.
You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, and you know, the results showed. I think, you know, with the Republicans gaining a solid grip on both houses for a right. while there, that I think that really showed up. You know, obviously they say that in mid-year elections the president's party tends to lose seats, but I think the Democrats lost more than they needed to.
In 2010.
Yeah, right. That's
Obama could have put his organization to work for Democrats, mm-hmm. and he didn't.
I never really understood that. I thought
I didn't either.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's
agreed on that one.
If Barack Obama's listening, you come as a guest on my program, and I want to ask you that. Why the heck? What was the deal there? But, hey, we got a caller on the line now. Ted from Shelburne's with us. Good morning, Ted.
Yes, thank you very much. I've had the thought that the job description of POTUS is way different than it was 4 years ago. And I certainly supported Bernie then,
mm-hmm.
and I also certainly voted for Hillary, you know, wishing I had a better choice. Mm-hmm. but it's the country has largely been turned to Swiss cheese in terms of foreign service and, you know, all of the appointees and all of the regulation disintegration. There needs to be a well-selected, powerful, effective team, and possibly Joe Biden can be more effective with people that will come around him and put their shoulder to the wheel, as opposed to mm-hmm. I'm not so sure how it would be with Bernie.
Yeah.
But what do you make of that, Linda Fowler?
I think that's a legitimate concern. He doesn't have the kind of connections to places around the country that would generate the kind of connections where he would have long-standing ties to people to hold cabinet positions.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, I was watching Greece when it was at its worst, and I'm not sure how many years ago, but when it was thinking. And they were aiming for the term, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but technocrats. Like, you really want professional mechanics working on your car and airplane and so forth. And so that people who really, I mean, that's just part of what I meant by getting the team that can put the shoulder to the wheel and straighten out, because it's, you know, I just feel it's, I can't imagine another 4 years without an administrative change, because we're so Swiss cheesed, I guess, I'm thinking of, just in the terms of structure of government and management and society.
Ted, interesting observation. Thank you very much for the call. I wonder, though, let me ask you, Linda Fowler, I mean, to me, one of the fascinating things about a Sanders administration, if such a thing were to come to pass, would be, I think this goes right to the question of, my guess is that there, and you know academia a lot better than I do, but my guess is that there are people on faculties at colleges and universities around the country who basically are, you know, sort of progressive, left-leaning, beyond the normal Democratic roster of cabinet appointees in their politics, but would be people who Bernie Sanders could bring in. I mean, it strikes me that there probably is a team that could be assembled. They just aren't people we've heard of before. You know, the Republicans keep recycling the John Boltons of the world. We would probably hear some names we had never heard before in connection with, you know, leading federal appointments and so on. Mm-hmm. But aren't there people out there who would be ready to go?
Well, there are a lot of people from the Obama administration, and Obama, if you recall, it was unusual in the lack of scandal, mm-hmm. And in the caliber of the people that he appointed to major posts. And you're right, we hadn't heard a lot of, they were not Clinton people. Obama had found them. But I think the difference is that it's not clear whether Bernie will be inclined to let those people do their job. What's driving him is ideology, not results.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why some people are worrying that we might just trade left-wing chaos for right-wing chaos.
Well,
and I think a lot of people, certainly your last caller, they just want calm. they want, you know, they want the test for the coronavirus to be done, and they want the potholes fixed, and all of the things that are not, you know, are not functioning well. So, you know, it may be that a lot of people in this country really don't want to be inspired anymore. They simply want a government that works, because ours is so demonstrably not working.
Well, again, I'm not a complete cheerleader for Bernie Sanders, I really don't think, but I do want to mention that when he was mayor of Burlington, the city of Burlington, it seemed to run pretty smoothly and actually created some new programs and really, by most accounts, became a better place to live during his decade or mm-hmm. so in office there. If you look at that past versus the past of Trump's airline mm-hmm. or Trump's stakes or Trump's university or Trump's bankrupt casinos, I think you can already...
Very favorable comparison.
Big difference. Yeah. So to say that Bernie's just bookends Trump on the left or something, I think is not accurate. I mean, there may be other reasons you don't like the. And speaking of not liking the whole socialist revolution idea, I look at Bernie Sanders, hear what he says, and I say, thank God somebody's talking about nuance here and trying to introduce, you know, another thought into the conversation, because the conversation is so sort of just a mm-hmm. duopolistic or kind of crazily simple, frankly. And I found that Pete Buttigieg is my biggest complaint with his remarks, typical debate or speech or whatever. They were just content free. He kept talking about building communities and making change. And I'm like, change to what? He never really told us any detail. So, you know, the things Sanders does, he'll try to go to that next level of actual content and nuance, and so he'll talk about, well, maybe Castro wasn't all bad because of his literacy program. But, you know, then he fails to, that opens up a whole new can of worms, and he doesn't go to the next level of nuance, which says that the ability to read is a gift, but the right to read what you want is a very, very important thing also. The literacy program is greatly diminished in value when people can't go to a bookstore in Havana and pick up Ayn Rand or Milton Friedman. And you know, if you could get to that layer, then I would be frankly more impressed. But so the Democratic Party is really at the horns of a dilemma here. If they nominate Bernie Sanders, they could alienate and anger a whole bunch of moderate members of the party who might be much less enthusiastic about showing up. If they fail to nominate Bernie Sanders, they alienate and anger a lot of the Bernie Sanders supporters. And the big unifying force there, Linda Fowler of Dartmouth College, I'm guessing, actually is Donald Trump.
Right. This is a battle that the party had in the 80s and 90s. And it was resolved for a while by Bill Clinton. He moved the party to the center, but the more progressive wing, having supported George McGovern and Michael Dukakis, and they got tired of losing. So Clinton prevailed, but always narrowly, and people were in the party were very suspicious of the fact that he, you know, he was too pragmatic.
Triangulating all the time.
So this fight is just, it's just kind of resurfaced.
That's interesting. Now here's the theory that I hear from Bernie Sanders and from, you know, I have very close friends and loved ones who are big Sanders supporters, and they have this belief that if Sanders somehow gets the nomination, suddenly will awaken the other half of the country that never votes, and they'll all have a reason to turn out and really shake things up and elect this new guy and set a new direction for the country. Any truth to that rumor?
I'd like to see the evidence for it. Now, there certainly were new voters who came into the Nevada caucuses, and that sort of confirmed the argument. But so far, on Tuesday, young voters were only about 15% of the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to do a lot better with young people to make that, in terms of getting the turnout up, to make that claim, I think. Because the exit polls show that women are quite reluctant to support him. He didn't do as well as I expected. And African Americans are sort of not hostile, but lukewarm. So the voters are going to, there has to be some kind of a surge of, and the obvious people would be young people. And so far, in the early contest, that didn't happen at all. He actually did worse in New Hampshire in 2020 than he did in 2016. And the same I see was true in Vermont.
Yeah, isn't that something?
So I know people believe this, and I would love to believe it. I think our turnout rates are appalling, but I'd like to know where the evidence is before I place that kind of a bet.
That's very well put. It's exactly the question is, you know, show me something to indicate that is more than just a pipe dream, and I might start to believe it myself. But I frankly think that this was described to me one day recently by a family member who said that, you know, the guy who manages three Denny's restaurants is going to vote for Trump, but the 90 cooks and wait staff at those restaurants are all going to vote for Sanders. And I'm just not sure. I haven't polled the wait staff at Denny's lately, but, you know. I understand the class analysis there, obviously, but it's beyond
that. Right.
What And it might be, it might even be worth a try if the stakes weren't quite as high as the idea that, you know, I think a lot of Democrats and progressives and folks in general are really, really worried about what would happen to the United States if we have four more years of Trump.
I think there's a big unknown also about this claims of new voters. Mm-hmm. First of all, we know that there are efforts being made on social media, as there were in 2016, to discourage people from voting. African Americans were targeted quite heavily in that score, and their turnout was down in places like Michigan. We also know that some states have been purging their voter rolls, and although there's some pushback back by groups run by people like Stacey Abrams and Eric Holder, my colleagues who analyze vote turnout and ballot rules telling me that those efforts have in fact succeeded in depressing turnout where they've been attempted in places like North Carolina. So I guess the real question, if Bernie's shot in the arm of the electorate were so powerful that it would neutralize efforts that are being made to active efforts being made to suppress turnout, that would be huge. I should say huge.
But
it's hard to see right now what that means in terms of what Bernie's actually doing or what he would do to make that happen in the general election if he got the nomination. Justice Biden needs to reassure Bernie supporters that he's going to listen to them. I think Bernie has to reassure a lot of people in the Democratic Party that he's prepared to listen to them. And right now, the two sides are not talking.
Neither side seems to be trying real hard. I want to go back to that question of voter suppression for a moment, though, because one of the things that has occurred to me for a while now is that, I mean, Mike Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, two billionaires who basically went on ego trips, and they did not end well for them. Imagine if they took some of their money and instead they put it into Stacey Abrams or Eric Holder's group, and they basically, regardless of who the nominee is, they go out to Wisconsin, where the state legislature just voted to try to suppress a lot of voting from areas typically voting Democratic. And they knock on every door and they say, hey, Grandma, if you need a third form of ID, you know, let's go down to the DMV and get that for you right now on March 4th.
Yeah.
So you're ready to go, and we're gonna update you periodically on what you need to do to meet the next hurdle that your Republican legislature is going to put up in front of you, and really, you know, run regardless of whoever the nominee is going to be, but run a very serious campaign voter registration drive in all of these states where the Republicans have been putting the hammer down here. Would that be helpful?
Oh, I think it would make a big difference.
What a better way to spend their money than winning the American Samoa primary, huh?
Well, now, Bloomberg's his speech this morning, apparently he's told his staff people that they're staying in the field.
Okay.
So they're not working for his candidacy anymore. They're working for Biden. Biden's not controlling them, but basically I think the idea is that's exactly what he has in mind. Let's not forget also that a lot of the ads that Bloomberg ran were ads against Trump.
Yeah.
They were not. So I think actually Bloomberg has that in mind. I don't know about Steyer.
Okay. We are fast approaching the top of the hour here, I hate to say, which means the end of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And I hate to interrupt you, but I want to thank you very much before we run out of time to do so. Linda Fowler, excellent conversation this morning. You are a professor of political science at Dartmouth College. Thank you so much for being my guest.
You're so welcome, Dave. Take care.
All righty. We are going to go to the top of the hour, end of the Dave Graham Show here on this Wednesday, March the 4th, 2020. Don't forget about our podcast, folks. Just go to that WDEVradio.com homepage. Follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll find a list of our recent shows by topic and guest. Listen to your heart's content. And that's about it for our program today. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. We'll be back with another edition of the Dave Graham Show tomorrow here on WDEV FM and AM. Have a great day, everybody.